Welcome to our online course, Setting Up Successful Diabetes Education Programs and Medicare Reimbursement. My name is Beverly Tomasian, and I'll be your instructor for this course. We're going to be exploring strategies to set up diabetes education programs, and I have been fortunate enough to be a program manager for an ADA recognized education program for the past 14 years, so I'm familiar with the ins and outs of setting up a program, following the rules, and also we've really modified the way we present the information so our patients get the most out of the experience. And also important to keep a program up and running financially, we have to be familiar with reimbursement. So we'll be covering that also. This program is great for your practice setting and also a great program to help prepare for the CDE exam. This program is approved for 1.5 contact hours for registered nurses, California pharmacists, and registered dietitians. Since we are an accredited provider with the Commission on Dietetic Registration, all hours earned for this program can be applied toward your CDE. To increase the usability and resources in this PowerPoint, we have embedded hyperlinks within the PowerPoint presentation. So if you see a word underlined in yellow, click on it, and it will bring you to a new link that explains a particular topic or principle, or maybe it has some educational resource that you can take advantage of. For this course, we'll be discussing the following objectives. Number one, we'll describe the 2012 National Standards for Diabetes Self-Management Education and Support, now described as DSMES programs. Every few 4 to 5 years, these standards are updated, so these are the most recent standards available. We'll also look at the 10 standards and describe how to apply them in our practice setting. And finally, we'll wrap up looking at the diabetes services and products that are covered by Medicare, also known as CMS. When we're thinking about the 2012 National Standards for Diabetes Self-Management Education and Support, we want to realize that these standards are evidence-based, and this is very important because what they're saying now is that there's great research showing diabetes education, self-management education, and support improves outcomes. People who receive education have lower A1Cs, better quality of life. So this is based on sound research. They wanted to make sure when they wrote these standards that it has wide applicability. And as I was reading through these standards and reviewing them, they have made them incorporate more breadth so they are more applicable to different settings. And also, seeking these standards or working toward these standards does assure quality. So these standards are set forth to help us to provide a framework so that we provide the best quality programs to our patients so they have the best outcomes. And what these standards are not are specific guidelines. You'll see as we go through this, there's a lot of room for interpretation and application. And it is not a reimbursement guide. But what it is helping guide us toward is the best education, self-management programs and support programs that we can possibly create. Thinking about what is diabetes self-management education, and this is a very important definition. If you're planning on taking the exam, I would be very familiar with this definition. And also, I think it's really good to keep in mind as we provide education to our patients with diabetes. It's easy to just check off the checklist of all the topics we need to cover, but truly, education is much more dynamic than that. It's an ongoing process of facilitating the necessary knowledge, skills, and ability for diabetes and pre-diabetes self-care. And I think the key words here really are ongoing and facilitating. We really want to make sure our patients can keep this momentum up and that we're there for them when they're struggling. The other thing that's important here in this definition, and that's new, is that they've included not only diabetes, but pre-diabetes. And as this standard moves forward, whenever they use the word diabetes, we're thinking about not only people who are diagnosed with diabetes, but those with that pre-diabetes. This part of the definition is so important, too. The process incorporates the needs, goals, and life experiences of the client. whatever that client brings to us during our assessment, during our intervention phase, during our follow-up phase, we have to consider at the center of this equation is the person living with diabetes every day. They're interacting with the healthcare professional maybe, you know, for 1% of their entire life. The other 99% of the time, they're managing diabetes on their own. So we're helping empower them and facilitate their behavior change and helping facilitate the best care outcomes. But that's generated by the person. The other thing I've mentioned already is that these standards are guided by evidence. So we know that these standards work, we've measured them, we've monitored them, and they do make a difference as far as outcomes. This is another very important slide because it looks at the overall objective. What are we trying to accomplish by providing diabetes self-management education? Well, it's pretty obvious, but I think it's just good to review that we're here to improve the health, outcomes, quality of life. We want to help our patients, you know, support their ability to make decisions and have informed decision making. So we're going to provide them with a different, for example, side effects of medications, or we're going to look at the different types of carbs that they can choose from so that they can make the informed decision. And we're going to help promote self-care behaviors, and this is so important, problem solving. You know, we may have a great plan that the patient has worked out with you and that worked for a time, but maybe the new problem pops up and the patient is running into a barrier. How do we help them work around the barrier, go over the barrier, under the barrier? There's a lot of problem solving and active collaboration when we're working with clients with diabetes. And the research shows us programs that incorporate behavioral and psychosocial strategies have the best outcomes. So not only are we going to identify the resources that person needs and the information, we're going to help with behavior change, and we're going to also kind of find out where they are from a psychosocial perspective to help get resources for them if they're really struggling, for example, with depression, lack of social support, isolation. Those are issues that are going to be barriers to diabetes care. So we want to identify those and help the person get the resources they need. So as diabetes educators and advocates, we're always trying to connect our patients to other resources in the community or professional resources or their friends or, you know, their places of worship where they can get the ongoing support and psychosocial support that they need. Diabetes self-management support is a new term that they've added to the standards of care starting in 2012 because, as I've mentioned, education is one component, but the support is so important for sustaining behavior change. And the support is defined as activities that help the person with diabetes or pre-diabetes to sustain and implement those behavior changes. Because we realize their condition is going to last for the rest of their life. They need that support. And there's different forms of support that we can offer, and it can be behavioral, educational, psychosocial, or clinical. But I think the support really implies that it's not just that initial session that we do with them or the classes. Support is that ongoing friend reaching out, ongoing follow-up that helps the patient sustain behavior change and coping skills for the long term with their diabetes. I would definitely encourage you to read this article if you're setting up a diabetes program and if you're going to be taking the CDE exam. This article is well written, it's not that long, and it has a lot of great information about the National Standards for Diabetes Self-Management Education and Support. And it's all evidence-based, so if you're trying to share with your employer the reasons why you should have a diabetes education program, you could certainly look at the references in that article to help support your argument. I posted it here on this online course on the resource tab, but also you can Google it and find it for yourself in Diabetes Care, September-October 2012. Again, I think it's well worth your time to review this information and be familiar with it for your own practice, but also for the exam. So why would someone who's working in a diabetes education capacity want to have a nationally recognized DSMES program? It's a lot of work to get it set up, and there's two accrediting bodies, the American Diabetes Association or the American Association of Diabetes Educators. Why would we go through all this work to set up a program? Well, number one is it really helps with reimbursement. So while this guideline does not talk about reimbursement, in order for Medicare to reimburse for your program, you must be nationally recognized either by the ADA or the AADE for Medicare to provide payment for your individual assessment and the group classes. Other private payers may or may not require this recognition, but certainly you would want to say to the private payer, if you don't have the recognition, we're following the standards as listed here. The other thing I think it's really important is it tells your community, it tells your providers, your colleagues that we're a place of excellence. We've really invested a lot of time in developing an excellent diabetes program. We're meeting the goals, we're measuring outcomes, we're looking at the patient as a center focus of our program to help them change behavior and sustain behavior change over a long period of time. And the other thing that really is helpful about getting recognized, and I found this true in my position, is that you get a lot of organizational support and commitment. Because to get a recognized program, you need to engage administration and upper-level management. And they need to make a financial commitment, because it costs money to get recognized, over $1,000, and you have to renew that every 3 to 4 years, depending on your type of recognition. So they need to provide an ongoing commitment. You need space. You need resources. So you have to, as an educator, reach out to your upper-level management and engage them and get their support and really sell them on the importance of diabetes education and self-management training. And, of course, the most important thing is that we know this works. We're going to improve patient outcomes, quality of life, daily quality of life, and long-term quality of life. It's great for the person. It's great for our community. Diabetes education and self-management training is a win-win proposition. So that's why we do it, and that's why we really pursue meeting the standards as far as diabetes education to garner the support, financial support, and also structural and resource support. So if you're thinking about setting up a program, what do you need? Well, you need a plan. And the plan is your vision. And you have to commit it to paper and really think it through as far as how are you going to proceed in operationalizing this. So you need a very clear plan, and you need lots of energy and tenacity. Once you get it rolling, it has a nice momentum on its own. But just the setup. The setup is the most, I would say, labor intensive, because you're getting all your documentation, your curriculum, and then you're selling it to administration. The other thing that you really need are staff, and I would say instructors are important, but just as the instructors, a support person, a secretary, somebody to take the phone calls, to do your invoicing and your billing, somebody who appointments patients and calls people back and helps you put together all your teaching materials. In the 14 years I've been doing the diabetes education program at my hospital, I'm there one day a week. My secretary is there 20 hours a week. She is a life force of this program because she's doing all the activities that help sustain it, give it momentum, getting back to patients. Then I can come in and provide the instruction and talk to patients and meet with patients and do policies and procedures. So she's freeing me up to do the stuff that I have expertise in. So I think such an important role is having that support person dedicated to your program, so that frees you up, so you can see the patients, teach the classes, and do the quality improvement that needs to happen as part of recognition. So those are just some really important things. And the other issue, of course, is space. Having a dedicated space to see patients individually and as part of the group setting. We'll be going over this more, but these are just kind of some things to start thinking about. And if you already have a program going and you want to grow it, you might want to consider a new plan for the future, because we're a dynamic situation. We're always trying to change and improve and make our program, better as far as meeting the needs of our community and our patients. And so these are the other things that we've talked about that we need to incorporate into our plan. As far as the national standards, I keep talking about the 10 standards, so I just thought I'd provide them in an overview, and we'll go over each of these individually. You can see we need an internal structure, external input, we need to find access for our patients, we need staff and a program coordinator, we need a curriculum, what we're going to teach from, we need to individualize our program for each patient, support, patient progress, and quality improvement. And they've changed the terminology in a lot of these because what they said in these new standards of 2012 is, you know what, we want to make sure it's English. We want to make sure people can understand what we're talking about. So I think they've done a really nice job of making this information a lot more accessible and understandable and really, I think, gearing toward improved patient outcomes. The first standard is internal structure, and I think it's interesting that they changed this from the DSME entity to the provider of diabetes self-management education, because they realized sometimes the diabetes management program is just one person working 10 hours a week. So it can be a provider or providers will document an organizational structure. So you need to, you know, get together with your administrative people and say, what's our administrative structure? And then you develop a mission statement and your goals. We'll go over some examples of those. For those providers who work in a larger organization, that organization will recognize and support the DSME as an integral component of diabetes care. So you may be an individual provider, or you might be a part of a bigger program. Either way, we need to determine where we fit within the organization and get the support we need and determine a mission statement and goals. So you want to start putting together a portfolio of documenting your internal structure. And I have this really nice graphic here that says vision. So this to me is your vision of your program. What is your organizational chart? What are your policies and procedures? For example, how do patients come to see you? Is there a referral form? And then once the referral form is sent to you, do you document that somewhere? And then how do you track if patients don't arrive for the appointment? So these are part of your policies and procedures. Maybe you help adjust medications. Do you have an algorithm procedure for medication adjustment? Those are some of the types of things that would be included in this portfolio. You want to make sure you have a job description, if you're an instructor or the program coordinator, that anybody involved in your team has that job description. And these documents should not just be documents you do once and then put away forever. They should be documents that are really helping guide you and really reflect your current practice. And then you want to do meeting minutes. If you meet with your committee, if you have informal meetings or formal meetings, you might just want to jot down a note. And there's no grades for neatness. You just want to, you know, document what you're doing, how you're meeting with your stakeholders and your other teams and colleagues, and document that's happening as part of your overall plan. And here I mentioned the word stakeholders. Now, stakeholders is pretty interesting. We'll talk about them more in a minute. But who are your stakeholders? You might want to think about who that would be. Who has an investment in your program? Who wants it to succeed? Who could provide quality feedback and ideas for you to help make your program the best program possible? The thing I want you to remember is that no diabetes educator is an island. So many times we feel like we're the only ones out there, you know, raising the awareness about diabetes, but please reach out to your colleagues. And you'll be surprised. A lot of your colleagues have friends or family members with diabetes, and they have a real passion for it too. So reach out to management and the wonderful support staff and others. For example, our secretaries that, you know, program support people can make such a big difference in improving outcomes. Working with accounting, making sure the billing is being done correctly and that we're setting up our billing structure to maximize our revenue. And of course, be honest and fair. Information systems. How can we document our interaction and our interventions that we provide for patients? Information systems can also help generate glucose reports and show us in the inpatient setting who's running hyperglycemia, who's running hypoglycemia. They can help us see who received injections of D50 or glucagon or maybe glucose tabs. So IT and pharmacy often work together to reveal information for us about practice patterns in the inpatient setting. Case management, another such an important team member, helping patients get ready for discharge. Do they know that your services are available, maybe in the inpatient setting and also in the outpatient setting as far as providing ongoing diabetes education, or maybe you have a support group? Home health. So once home health discharges the patient, then they can come utilize our services. So making sure we're on the radar of home health. We're always thinking about referral sources, collaboration, helping patients get the resources that they need. And then others, lately what's been really on my radar is sleep apnea. A lot of patients with diabetes have sleep apnea. So putting our brochures in the sleep apnea lab and talking to sleep apnea about the importance of managing, you know, blood sugars to help improve outcomes. And then our marketing department, working with marketing, helping them understand the value of diabetes education. I find that the marketing department often really appreciates promoting diabetes education, especially recognized programs, because it shows the community that we're a center of excellence, that we really care about diabetes. We're putting energy and time into making it the best program. So I would just say, many times, you know, we forget to reach out to others who can be there to support and move our efforts forward. So I would just encourage you to do that. Writing a mission statement can be a daunting task, especially if you're doing it in a group. So probably the best strategy is just to say, okay, let's just start with an idea. Somebody say something and get a whiteboard or have a flip chart and just start writing the ideas down in a brainstorming fashion. And then maybe people can work on it on their own and submit their ideas. And then you could vote on something or whatever process, you know, you need to use. Or maybe you write the mission statement and then you ask people, what do you think about this? So you can do it more collaboratively or more individually. Here's an example of a mission statement. Our diabetes program is here to help you feel your best, take care charge of your diabetes, and lower your risk of complications. So your mission statement can be personal, it can be direct, and it can really reflect what your program's goal and underpinning philosophy is all about. Examples of program goals. We mentioned that you want to set goals for your program. So here's just some examples that you might be thinking about or that might help get you started and your own goals. So for the following year, maybe you want 15 participants to actually attend each class. So that could be a goal. Or maybe there's pressure on your department to generate revenue. I mean, I know that hospitals and outpatient departments have to look at their bottom line. They have to be fiscally responsible. So you're going to keep a close eye on your budget. And maybe you know that you're trying to cover your program expenses, at least 50% of them. So to reach that 50% mark, you need to increase your revenue by $10,000. Be familiar with your income statements, and you want to make sure you know how much revenue you're generating, how much your department costs the hospital or your outpatient clinic. And you want to try and close those gaps if you can so that you have ongoing administrative support. Maybe another goal you would like is to increase your provider referrals to 300 a year. So going out, talking to providers, marketing your program might be one of the goals that you want to do, because if patients aren't referred to us, we can't provide them education. I find it difficult myself personally to go out and market my program, because I'm like, my program's great. We drop A1Cs by 1.4%. On average, people lose 14 pounds by attending our program, and quality of life really improves. I know that, but our providers don't know that. How do they find out? We tell them. So it's difficult for a lot of us to get out there and market our program, but I would just really encourage you to do that and feel comfortable with it, because our main goal is to get patients to come in to see us and really benefit from that information. Standard 2 looks at external input, and this used to be called advisory committee. So I think this is very interesting that they've even made it more global. And that is, the provider of DSME will seek ongoing input from external stakeholders and experts in order to promote program quality. So this gives us a lot of flexibility as far as who we define as our stakeholders and experts and who we involve in our yearly planning and goals. Definitely, though, external input is very valuable. It does provide guidance for solo or group providers. And really, when you think about talking to your stakeholders, you're looking to better serve your community. Sometimes if you're just kind of in an isolated situation, you may not realize that the needs of your community are changing, or maybe there's some gaps in services. So reaching out to the stakeholders can really be beneficial that way. We really want to build bridges to key stakeholders. So as we maybe there's a pharmacy in town that does a lot of diabetes education, they're a stakeholder in your program. Putting their brochures with with them for your program, talking to them, saying, you know, we're here to support your efforts for diabetes care. That could be a potential stakeholder, or it could be some a physician or provider who has expertise in diabetes, or it could be a community member. Maybe there's a community member who's very involved in a diabetes support group, or, you know, talks a lot about diabetes. That could be a stakeholder. So we definitely know that reaching out for external input can increase the dynamicism of our program. It can help us keep focus on making sure our program offers support, is patient-centered, and it's relevant, and there's more consumer appeal. Community stakeholders are very important in helping sustain our program's viability, keeping it dynamic, keeping it fresh. So, as we've mentioned before, stakeholders could include healthcare professionals, people with diabetes, other community members. And the other thing that's important to keep in mind is that the DSME provider must have a documented plan for seeking outside input and not just gathering that information, but taking action on it. So this is not just a standard that says, oh, if you feel like it asks for external input, and this says you need to document what people are saying, these stakeholders, and then if you're going to act on it or not act on it, there needs to be documentation. In the Standards of Care for 2012, they do say that external input is often best achieved by a formal advisory board. So if that's a possibility for you, the formal advisory board, for example, we have one in our community. We meet once a year formally, but many times during the year informally. But during that presentation at the end of the year, I go over, because I am the program manager, our goals, if we've met the goals, and I look at quality improvement. We have to review our curriculum and our space and our resources. So it is a time where I am responsible for sharing the program, what's going well with it, what we're struggling with, and seeking their input. So who is on your board? It could be lots of different people that could be participating as your stakeholder on your more formal advisory board. But anyone passionate about diabetes, it can be very instrumental in your program's success. You want to keep your program energized, patient-centered, dynamic, and relevant. And here's my team. This is a picture it's a few years back, so many of these team members have moved on or retired, but the core is still there working hard to provide diabetes education. As I mentioned, if you have a formal advisory board, these are some of the topics you would like to cover during your meeting. What are the goals? What's the data? Mission statement, reviewing that, looking at organizational structure, population, resources, and I think this is such an important time to talk about these things, especially resources. How are we doing as far as personnel, space, and looking at the curriculum? Is our curriculum fresh? Do we need to update it? How is our approach working? And I'll just tell you, in our own program, we really have moved away from doing didactic instruction to more just sitting down, bringing up topics with our clients and starting a discussion. And then as that discussion continues, organically what needs to be discussed comes up. So we're not as tied to that standardized curriculum. We're doing it more through discussion-based learning. And it seems that most of the time we get through the content that needs to be covered. So we always are customizing it to the group and what the people in the group need. And then we're looking at our outcomes. What are our behavioral outcomes? Are people changing behavior? That's a very important measure. And also looking at the various clinical outcomes. So this meeting, I find, really helps keep me on track as a program manager to say, this is where we're really falling short, this is where we're excelling, and this is where we need to go. And the feedback of my colleagues and the community members is it's just invaluable to help keep that program fresh and really improving. Standard 3 has to do with access, and currently the majority of people with diabetes and prediabetes do not receive any structured diabetes education. So there's many barriers to DSME, but one of the biggest barriers is access. So we want to really figure out, how do we reach our population of people that could most benefit from our services? How do we best deliver that and what resources can we provide for ongoing support of the population? So this really has to do with our assessment of our community, how to reach those people, especially people with lacking transportation, maybe people who aren't insured, people who are really the most neediest but have a hard time accessing our services. And then there's others maybe who are less needy, but their provider may not refer, so they still don't have access to our programs. How do we reach out to find those patients and invite them in to our community of learning? Understanding our community is very important. We want to look at the characteristics, the age distribution, ethnic groups, and special needs, literacy, and different resources. In my community where we work with an elderly population. It's a retirement community. So we know that offering classes in the evening never works well. It's difficult for our older clients to drive at night. They don't feel safe, so we have to offer our classes during the day. But what if you have a working population? If you have a working population, evening or weekend classes might be better for them. Then you want to look at your different ethnic and cultural groups. Can we incorporate those different aspects into our education to make it really relevant for our patients? And then what about special needs? We've had lots of patients, you know, in oxygen and wheelchairs, making sure your program is accessible to them. And then for patients struggling with literacy, I'm looking at different opportunities to provide information besides written and information that requires literacy. And then, of course, just adding to your bundle of resources, I'm always talking to our social worker, can you give me some resources, you know, for our patients who have trouble with transportation, shopping, they're depressed, you know, they need counseling, they need somebody to talk to. So getting your resources together in a big binder so that you have easy access to it can really make a big difference. When you're thinking about your target population, it may be everybody within a certain community, or you may be really looking at a subgroup within your population. So maybe you're looking for people with type 1, maybe gestational, maybe low-income families, or kids, or more vulnerable populations. We're hearing a lot more now about food insecurity, you know, with the economy taking a difficult turn lately. Many of our patients and families are just struggling to eat. So they're just in the very basic level of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, food, shelter. And so maybe diabetes education isn't on their radar. We're going to have to consider that as we reach out to these different groups. Think about their barriers, their needs, and their perceived barriers and perceived needs also. Considering your referral source is so important. Where do our patients come from? To keep a program vibrant, we need clients. So we're going to reach out to local clinics. Maybe we're going to talk to the inpatients side and say, and set up a system for referrals. We've done that in our hospital where the nurse who does the admission can check on diabetes nurse consultation. And even if we can't see them in the inpatient setting, we will call them after discharge. Are we getting our referrals from private doctor's offices? Or maybe we can attend health fairs. And maybe our employees, you know, many of our employees have diabetes. 8% of the population has diabetes. Probably 8 to 10% of the people you work with have diabetes. Reaching out to them, I think is very important part of what we do, because we want to say we're going to reach out to you, and then the employees can in turn share with the community the programs that we offer. I've talked about pharmacy policymakers. Who in your community moves policy? Is there a mayor that you can meet with if it's, you know, if that's your town isn't very large, like maybe in Los Angeles, you're not going to be able to meet with Mayor Villaraigosa. But if you live in a small town like where I teach my classes, the mayor is very accessible to me. So who is a person in your community who drives policy? Can you talk to them? And maybe somebody in your hospital community or your outpatient community. And then employer groups, talking to the different employer groups who refer to you, letting them know about your services. You want to be well known in your community. You want your stakeholders and your patients to market your program and say what a tremendous resource that you provide to help improve diabetes care. If you're just setting up a diabetes program, you're going to do your initial assessment. But even for those of us with long-standing diabetes programs, I think it's important for us to, you know, assess our community on a regular basis because things change, demographics shift, needs, you know, our needs are modified over time. So after our assessment is done, we're going to think about volume and then what time are the classes best offered and how often. You want to make sure that we don't have classes with two people because you're using a lot of resources for the instructors to come and teach this for a few patients. We want to maximize our efficiencies so that we can keep our program vibrant. What's the structure of our program? Look at where are we providing the classes. Do we provide snacks during our classes? I think this is interesting. Are we going to do cooking demonstrations? Are we going to just provide water? You know, if patients are coming during a mealtime, they may get hungry and they might be at risk for hypoglycemia. And then we're going to look at our barriers. What are some things that stop people from attending? Identify the barriers, find ways around them. And then look at, based on all of that, what are our staffing needs? And who's going to bill? How do we get support for our computers? And how do we track our patients? And who's going to, you know, provide instructions? And for the instructors that are participating, how are they going to get their CEs to keep current with diabetes information? So these are all the things that are going into our planning process. And if you're already an established program, these are things that I still consider on an ongoing basis to keep my program moving forward and being successful. The program coordinator role is standard 4. And what is the role of the program coordinator? Well, they're the overseer. They're going to make sure that the program is implemented and that it's evaluated. Now, what is the requirement for the program coordinator? This is interesting. They don't have to be a nurse or CDE or board certified in advanced diabetes management. But what they do need to possess is a knowledge of the lifelong process of managing a chronic disease and facilitating behavior change, in addition to program management experience. So you can see when they were talking about a broad scope, this is pretty broad in its definition. So it's giving us room for interpretation. But definitely there's a main thing that goes, the main theme that goes through this is that the person needs skills and experience in chronic disease management and program management. And then, of course, for the program coordinator, a job description and resume must be on file. The coordinator's role does not have to be hands-on. They don't have to be this instructor. They could just be kind of overseeing things from afar. They may be managing multiple programs, like maybe they're doing chronic disease management, and part of that is diabetes, asthma, and CHF. So they're going to be involved in the continuum of diabetes care and related conditions when feasible. But you can see it says when feasible. So they may be more involved or less involved, but they're certainly kind of overseeing the overall program and looking at its outcomes. Standard 5 has changed a lot over the years, and we're going to be talking about the instructional staff. So what it's saying is one or more instructors will provide DSME, which is education, and when applicable, the support aspect also. However, really important to keep in mind is that many people can be instructors in the program, but at least one of the instructors who was responsible for designing and planning DSME and DSMS will be an RN, an RD, or a pharmacist, and that person needs to have training and experience pertinent to DSME. So you can be an RN, RD, or pharmacist, be the primary instructor, even if you don't have your CDE, as long as you're getting the education as outlined in the standards set forth by the ADA and AADE. In addition, another professional with a certification in diabetes care can provide or be the primary instructor, as long as they have a CDE or a BCADM, and I'll talk about that more in the next slide. The CDE or BCADM can be accepted credential for the solo instructor, and additionally, a CDE who is not an RN, RD, or pharmacist may be a solo instructor. Two examples of that are somebody, for example, who's a CDE exercise physiologist or CDE physical therapist or social worker. Even though they're not an RN, RD, or pharmacist, they can be the primary solo instructor as long as they have the CDE. This is a very important change in the standards, and I think it's important because it opens up the ability to rural areas or areas who may not have an RN, RD, or pharmacist to provide the education to set up a diabetes self-management program. In addition to the primary or solo instructor, other health workers can contribute to DSME and provide DSMS with appropriate training in diabetes and with supervision and support. So more what they're talking about in this bullet point is saying that lay community health workers, medical assistants can also contribute and be a part of the teaching team. They just need to have supervision by the instructor and program manager. So this just talks about the disciplines that can be involved in instruction but are not limited to. So these are different people who could be instructors for you and work with you as part of your team. You can see physicians, psychologists, mental health professionals, physical activity specialists, physical therapists, exercise physiologists, optometrists, and then health educators, and case managers, lay and community workers, and peer counselors or educators. So there would have to be an instructor who is credentialed in the way that I mentioned in the earlier slide, but these others, instructors can be involved as part of the teaching team under the supervision of the program manager and the other instructional staff. There's been an emergence in the role of lay health community workers and peer counselors in many rural areas and underserved areas. These different professionals really improve outcomes in care for our patients with diabetes. And so we want to include them in our diabetes education team. So you can see they can contribute to DSME and diabetes support if they have received training in diabetes management, teaching self-management, group facilitation, and emotional support. And of course, there has to be a system in place to make sure that there's supervision of what the information is being shared by these community workers, peer counselors, and educators. So there's quality control. That I have worked myself with many community health workers and taught classes with them, and I am impressed with their knowledge, I'm impressed with their passion, and I am also impressed with their ability to reach out to community members, and really, they understand them, they're a part of that community, and they know the barriers that those people live with every day. So they're very excellent at really helping make inroads in moving people forward as far as behavior change and also getting them engaged in diabetes education programs. A standard curriculum is Standard 6, and the curriculum really needs to reflect current evidence and practice guidelines, and it needs to include additionally criteria for evaluating outcomes, and it really does serve as our framework for the provision of diabetes self-management education. Well, we have a curriculum, but the interesting thing it does say here is that, yes, there's a standardized curriculum, but really, you're going to base your education on the assessed needs of the individual to figure out what content areas will be provided. So just because we have these different content areas doesn't mean we have to cover every single one during a patient visit. Maybe they're really comfortable with monitoring. They've been checking their blood sugars forever, but they really need help with hypoglycemia prevention and medications. We may spend more time on that. Or maybe they're really struggling with nutrition, medical nutrition therapy, and carb counting. So anytime we work with our patients, they're going to drive the education. Their needs and what they come in with and their perceptions are going to inform us of what aspects of the curriculum we need to address. And that's true for the individual meeting and also the group setting. So as you're teaching your courses to your clients, you're going to ask questions, hear their feedback, see where they're struggling, and then you're going to let the group kind of help you determine what areas to focus on most. These are the required content areas, and they really do get back to the AADE7, which we'll go over later. But it's looking at the main components of diabetes self-management. What is diabetes? What are the treatment options? Medical nutrition therapy, activity, medications, monitoring. How do we prevent, detect, and treat not only acute complications, but also chronic? We're going to look at strategies to address psychosocial issues and strategies to promote health and behavior change. All of this content is incorporated into our curriculum with the main goal of helping people move toward behavior change and providing them with the education and support they need to succeed. This wording I took right out of the guidelines, and that it says, keep your curriculum dynamic and practical. Dynamic, changing, meeting the needs of your group. Every time you teach the course, it's going to be different because your group is going to be different. And you want to make sure it reflects practical information, take-home information. What to do when the blood sugars are too low. Let's talk about, you know, signs of low blood sugar. Tell me your signs of low, and then what action would you take? And it also should be reflective of current evidence and practice guidelines. So we always are considering the guidelines set forth by the American Diabetes Association, the American Association of Clinical Endocrinology, and so forth. We want to make sure our information is evidence-based. Patients come in with a lot of comments about, should I take this nutraceutical, or I heard you should never eat this type of food, or I heard this medication causes, you know, liver problems. So patients get a lot of misinformation. We're there to help them sort through all of that because we know we're basing our information on evidence. Recent education research says practical problem-solving approaches work best. Collaborative care, looking at what the barriers are, behavior change, and then so important and often overlooked, strategies to self-sustain. Strategies to sustain self-management efforts. It is self-management. How do we help our patients sustain that long-term self-care to help keep healthy? And that's going to be part of the follow-up plan we'll talk about later. Ongoing support for our clients with diabetes. I love this picture where it says focus on patient-centered needs. You kind of go out on a limb on this. You don't know where it's going to take you sometimes, but you want to be creative. You want to ask your patients what they need and let them talk through some difficult issues. You know, many times during class, patients will bring up really painful stuff and it's awkward and it's hard to manage sometimes, but that painful moment is so important for the group and for that person individually to acknowledge that painful experience. And then oftentimes I'll ask the group to help out. What would you do? What kind of help or support would you recommend? And many amazing things come out of those moments. So I would just encourage you, be creative. Use experiential-based delivery methods. And these are the most effective ones for helping support informed decision-making and really helping contribute to meaningful behavior change, which address psychosocial concerns. In addition to helping patients explore the different areas of knowledge and psychosocial issues, we have to get concrete with our patients and help them set behavioral goals. Now, this behavioral goal does not come from us. It comes from the person. We're going to ask our clients, what of all the things we've talked about today, what is one thing you'd really like to work on to help improve your diabetes? And I will tell you, I ask that question a lot, and many times I'm surprised by the goal that they choose because I would think, well, didn't you really want to choose, you know, exercise, but they chose something totally different. So the thing why I'm bringing this up is because patients know best what they need to work on. But we want to help them make a realistic goal. So we want to make sure it's specific. So specific means I will walk for 30 minutes three times a week. That's specific. Not I will lose weight or not I will exercise. You need to be very, hone them down to say, you know, how many days a week are you going to do it? What is your goal? And, you know, what's the long-term goal also? It needs to be measurable. Can you measure that? I will walk 30 minutes three times a week. Yes, you could see if you meet that goal or you don't meet it. Is it attainable and realistic? This is very important. Sometimes patients will say, well, I'm going to walk 7 days a week for 30 minutes, and they haven't exercised at all. That is not a realistic goal. So we work with them really hard, and we might say something like this. How confident are you that you'll be able to reach that goal? And maybe we could ask them on a scale of 1 to 5, 1 being least confident, 5 being most confident. And if they say, well, really a 1, we may want to say to them, where does that leave you? Would you like to modify your goal a little bit? So we want to help them to succeed. If a patient says, I'm going to exercise 7 days a week, that's a perfect score. And if they don't meet that goal, they're going to feel like they failed. We're trying to help make sure the goal is attainable, realistic. Timely means, for example, I'll exercise 3 times a week for a half an hour. So there's time involved and the frequency is also documented too. Setting goals is very important because it helps us figure out where we need to go and if we've succeeded or not. So I'm not looking at success or failure. If a patient comes back and they haven't reached their goal, we're going to identify barriers. Tell me what stopped you and your estimation from reaching your goal. Is there any barriers that you determined that were there that you weren't anticipating? And we're going to find ways around that. Behavioral goals, very, very important. Individualization, standard 7. And we've been talking about this throughout this entire online course. And that is, each participant has their own individual education needs. And the instructor, or more than one instructor, is going to assess those needs. So when we do that initial one-on-one assessment of the patient, when we have that time together, we're going to help determine their individual education and support needs. And based on that, we're going to develop a plan focused on behavior change. As part of our individualization, we're going to need to document our findings. So we're going to need to have an education record. Now, where can you find education records or checklists? You can go to ADA or AADE for samples of checklists to review, and they have examples of documentation too. So we need to have an assessment on record, an education plan with the behavioral goals. We need to talk about our interventions and the outcomes that we're seeking. So this is an important part of standard 7 to individualize, document what we've discussed with the patient, and also determining what kind of record keeping checklists that we want to use to document the work that we've done. So the diabetes educational process is very dynamic and it's ongoing. And what we are going to do as part of this process is we've talked about these first four. The fifth one here is referral to other resources. So we know if a patient comes in with depression, that they're going to need mental health support. What resources do we have available for them? What if we're a nurse CDE and they're asking a lot of nutrition questions? Yes, certainly as a CDE we cover nutrition, but they probably need the expertise of the dietitian to really delve into meal planning and medical nutrition therapy. So we're going to think about resources. What about podiatry? What if the patient has foot issues? Can we ask their primary care doctor for podiatry referral? What about sending them for dental issues? So maybe they have gum disease or cavities. Can we help get them moving towards seeing a dentist or a hygienist? The other thing that we're going to do as part of our educational process is evaluate the effectiveness of the interventions. So interventions include nutrition therapy, monitoring, medications, all of those, you know, exercise, all of those interventions. Are they working? Are they helping the patient reach their goals and providing that ongoing support and education? This educational process just loops back and forth, and you know, we may have to readdress certain things over again and come back to things. So it's an ongoing dynamic process. Maintaining documentation is very important. It tells our colleagues and the providers what work we've done with this client, what we're trying to work toward. So we wanted to document our individual assessment. We want to document what was provided in class. We want to communicate with the provider, make sure the labs are documented. And of course, we're going to look at labs before our intervention and after our intervention. We're going to document the goals, problem solving, and always we're going to be mindful of HIPAA and confidentiality as far as making sure all of that paperwork is secure. Documentation is a way of communicating. Whether you're doing it on the computer or you're doing it on paper, we need to make sure we share with the key stakeholders of that patient and their providers within that HIPAA, you know, keeping HIPAA in mind, the information that would be relevant and helpful to the team. The 8th standard talks about ongoing support. It used to be called follow-up assessment, but I think they've changed it to a name that better reflects what people with diabetes need. And you can see here, it's not just the instructor who figures out what the follow-up plan should be. It's the participant and instructor developed a personalized develop a personalized follow-up plan for ongoing support. I have a patient I see, and he has great insurance, and I see him every 3 months. Even if his A1C is 6.7, he says, I need to see you every 3 months to keep on track. And that's what we do. So that patient was very able to identify his need for ongoing support. Some of our other clients I see in our support group once a month, and at the end of the support group, we sit down and look at logbooks. So it really depends on the patient, their abilities, their resources, that determine what that follow-up plan will look like. The participant's outcomes, goals, and plan will be communicated to other members of the healthcare team. So we need to let others know what we've determined would be best for ongoing support. The importance of community resources cannot be overstated, because diabetes self-management takes place in participants' daily lives. They're out there 365, 24/7, living with their diabetes. So if we can find community-based resources to support their ongoing diabetes self-management, that's great. Maybe it's an exercise program for seniors. Maybe it's a support group for teenagers with diabetes. Whatever that looks like for the person, maybe it's Weight Watchers, maybe it's Overeaters Anonymous, maybe it's a stop smoking group. Whatever it is, reaching out to where they live, maybe it's in their church, their place of worship, their synagogue. So providers of DSME and DSMS can identify these services while communicating with providers of these resources. So we're going to reach out to our communities and find out what the resources are and share with those providers of resources what we're trying to accomplish and engage them in helping with those goals. And maybe, you know, they can send patients to us too, so we could share in this role of ongoing support. Here are some examples of ongoing support. We've mentioned a few of these, like Weight Watchers or YMCA, returning for medical visits, diabetes magazine subscription. I love the diabetes forecast. There's other diabetes magazines out there that are a real source of information for people and support. They feel like they're not alone. What about with new technology, using the internet, mobile health, blogging, tweeting? They're doing a lot with calling patients through their phone, through automated systems to remind them to take their medications. And there's a lot of behavior change phone-based programs to help patients, for example, who want to stop smoking or lose weight. They can get daily tweet reminders or phone call reminders. Oh, there's text messaging. And with many of my clients who are computer savvy, I have them email their blood sugars to me. So, you know, we just want to take advantage of those different technologies, because those do incorporate ongoing support for our patients. So it depends on your patient population, your resources, all of that goes into the mix, thinking what would work best for your clients for that ongoing support component. Standard 9 looks at the progress a patient is making. And this informs us that the provider of DSME and DSMS will regularly monitor whether patients are achieving their personal diabetes self-management goals. This is really important that we set the goals and then we work with our patients to monitor success or non-success. And why do we do this? Well, to evaluate the effectiveness of the educational intervention. So we want to see, did that educational intervention work? And it informs us, too, to say, wow, when I tried this approach, it didn't really work. But if I tried this, it really helped the patient meet their behavioral goals. So we want to look at the intervention success and use appropriate measurement techniques to document our degree of success. And I know when I submit my annual report for the American Diabetes Association, I have to say what percent of patients chose certain goals and how many of our patients met those behavioral goals and what was our benchmark, what were we trying to achieve. So I think that's a really excellent way to monitor behavior change achievement and to set our goals in a realistic way, and it informs us how we can be better educators at helping patients set realistic and smart goals. All of these slides are very important for our clinical practice, and also if you're thinking about taking the diabetes educator exam, but I think they're just in general good information. But this is really the key of this whole presentation, and that behavior change is the outcome we're looking for. And if you think about the American Association Diabetes Educator 7, that means the 7 essential factors where behavior change is really going to be a big focus. And we're familiar with these: physical activity, healthy eating, taking medications, blood glucose monitoring, diabetes self-care and problem solving, reducing risk of acute and chronic complications, and then that whole psychosocial aspect. So all of the behavior change goals fall within one of these 7. These are the 7 essential factors we want patients to succeed at. And sometimes we may focus on one more than another, but maybe we set initial goals and the patient achieves that, we might look at some different outcomes for that particular patient in a different category. This is the framework that we're working within. When we think about diabetes education and behavior change, these are the targets that we're trying to move patients toward, and these are our potential goal areas. Keep on the lookout for barriers. Sometimes I've heard patients being called non-compliant. They aren't non-compliant. They just can't achieve the goal. So that sounds kind of paradoxical, but the truth is the goal was unrealistic. The patient didn't have the resources for the goal. They weren't prepared for the goal. And so when I see patients not reaching goals, I'm just going to reach out to them and say, wow, we set this goal together. You weren't able to reach it. Do you have any insights into what stopped you from achieving it? Patients know. I mean, they live with themselves every day. They have a lot of expertise in their own motivation, what stops them. So we want to find out in their life what's happening. So be on the lookout for barriers. You know, things we didn't even consider could be a barrier. Maybe culture. Maybe a spouse. Maybe they're taking care of grandkids. Maybe they're just kind of worried about what their peers will think. And so I think really engaging and having honest communication, open dialogue, where the patient doesn't feel judged, can really help us to reveal those things that are stopping our patients from success. When we're thinking about tracking our outcomes, looking at clinical outcomes and patient goal setting and communications with their providers, do we have to, you know, rely on paper and pencil? Well, actually, in the medical setting, we do paper and pen, or do we have systems out there? And I've listed here 4 systems for you, and these are active links, so you could click on any one of these, and it will take you to that website. The AADE has a system, Chronicle Diabetes, that's the American Diabetes Association. That's a system we're using in our clinic. It's free, and the nice thing about the Chronicle Diabetes and the AADE, it's fed into a national database. Of course, patient names and confidentiality are not revealed, but it helps them to track generally nationally trends in diabetes, what goals patients are setting, what age group of patients we're seeing. So they're using that data in a way that can really help improve the understanding of diabetes care. Harbor Software, Tiara Diabetes Education Tracking, these are some commercially available products. So you can look at that and see, and based on your funding and your resources, you may be interested in some of these more than others. But I just wanted to let you know that they are out there. When we're thinking about tracking our data, we want to make sure that we have a system that works for us. Maybe it's an Excel spreadsheet. Maybe it's more sophisticated computerized tracking programs, or maybe it's one of the commercial ones that are available that I've mentioned. But the main thing here is there needs to be somebody to input that data and somebody to understand what that data means. So somebody to put the data together and somebody to interpret that data, and then you bring that back to your maybe an advisory committee or your stakeholders to say, hey, this is what's happening. How can we make this better? What's really working well? So the data is not just for the data. The data is to inform us of our success. It's to inform us of our program strengths. And as always, areas where gaps may be existing, where we're missing out on some important aspect of care. An example of measuring clinical outcomes is the following. To evaluate our success, we measured A1C results. And we wanted to see pre and post program, what was the change in A1C when the person was first enrolled into our program. And then you have to wait at least 3 months again. So 3 months later, we redrew the A1C to see, did the A1C drop after a person completed our program? And we saw an overall decrease of 1.1%, which equals success, because we know each 1 percentage point drop in A1C equals a 35% decrease in diabetes complications. So this is an example of a measurement of a clinical outcome. Another way of looking at the same data is to say, what patients were reaching the goal of A1C less than 7% before the program versus after the program? And you can see here in this graph, before the program, only 32% of patients had A1C less than 7, and after the program, 72%. And these are each, you know, the following sequential years. Oh, look at this. Before the program, 35% had A1C less than 7. After the program, almost 80%. So that's another way to report data out. And graphs, I think, are very effective in demonstrating the effect of the programs. And this is good data to share with the providers to say, you know, as an aggregate, overall, our A1Cs were much higher before the program than after graduation. And this is evidence-based. I mean, it's good, strong data that shows after our program, A1Cs improve. Other outcome measures can include knowledge. So you could provide patients with a pretest before they start the program and then see if their knowledge increased by providing a post-test at the conclusion of your program. The other question I think is so helpful on evaluation, so every patient, in my opinion, after they complete your program should fill out an evaluation sheet talking about their satisfaction with the program. Did they feel like it met their needs? And ask for feedback. We use our evaluations to really improve our program and make it better. And we do ask them, would you recommend this program to your friend or colleague? And 100% of patients said they would. And this is another good tool to share with your stakeholders that our program is so effective that 100% of people would recommend it. And then we ask our patients to rate our program. And you can see here, we saw 2% fair, and that was really a stimulus for us to think, wow, what can we do to make our program better? You know, that's probably only a few people responding fair, but we want to make our program excellent. So that was an impetus for us actually to change our curriculum, and we said, let's make our curriculum less didactic and more interactive. And since we've done that, our program ratings have gone up. So in conclusion, with Standard 9, we're looking at patient change measurement. We want to measure at regular intervals, looking at the patient-defined self-management goals. And then we want to see also their outcomes. So we're going to look at behavior change and clinical outcomes. We're going to use appropriate methods, and we may decide to measure other aspects too. But at least we want to measure a behavior outcome and a clinical outcome as part of our whole picture of how our patients are responding to our program. Standard 10 looks at quality improvement, and this is saying that the provider of the diabetes self-management education will measure the effectiveness of the education and support and look for ways to improve it, identify gaps in service and resources, and use a systematic review of process and outcome data. This is very important because this helps us identify where our program is doing well, and then it also helps us identify in a very objective way using systematic review of our data what areas could be improved upon. This is a nice framework that is part of the standards, and I think it really helps us have a better understanding of quality improvement and a real concrete way to identify it. So you have a fundamental question, and that is, what are we trying to accomplish? So for example, if your post-A1Cs, you're only getting 70% of patients to get their A1C drawn 3 months after the program, what you're trying to accomplish is at least 95% of your participants get A1Cs drawn after the program. How will we know a change is an improvement? That's a great question, because we want to document that our A1Cs go down as a result of the diabetes education intervention, and if we get more patients measuring the post-A1C, we get more data to support that our program is effective, or maybe the A1Cs don't go down and we can know we need to make some more changes to our program. What changes can we make that will result in the improvement? So this is setting up systems. How can we set up a system, for example, for patients to make sure they get a blood draw, you know, with after the program to evaluate their post-A1Cs? So that might be an issue of sending them a lab slip or having a A1C party where patients come back and get their A1Cs drawn. So this is where we make changes in the system to help improve the process. Quality improvement helps us to designate timelines and important milestones of data collection. So it helps keep us on track. We're looking for outcomes. We're measuring it. And then we analyze and present the results. So once we gather this data, it's not going to sit in the closet. We're going to bring it to our stakeholders and to our team to say, this is something we're really working on. We're trying to set up systems. What is your input to help this? Outcome measures indicate whether changes are actually leading to improvement and what caused those results. So this is a very important aspect of our program. And again, using these outcome measures helps us to quantify the change that we're helping patients make and also helps us to identify gaps in service. So this is, I think, a key to the success of any program. Generating revenue for our programs is an important aspect of what we do. We're going to be dealing with insurance companies and Medicare to help generate those revenues to help sustain our program. These next few slides will go over some of the issues involved with third-party payers and Medicare to help us be as informed as possible for our own practice and also for the diabetes exam. So depending on where you work, your revenue may come from different sources. If you're hospital-based and you do diabetes education in the hospital setting, diabetes education is considered part of usual care. So there's no extra funds that go in to pay for diabetes educators in the hospital setting. If we're hospital-based and we see, in addition to inpatients, outpatients, if we're an outpatient hospital-based program, we can get recognized by ADA or AADE and actually generate revenue for the education that we provide. Maybe you work in an HMO or you're clinic-based and you see only outpatients. So how we generate revenues in that situation would be very different. Many times you might just receive a salary to provide diabetes education as part of the overall structure of the HMO. And then there's private practice. Many diabetes educators, mostly dietitians, have a private practice or they might work in collaboration with other providers. And then we have our payers. So how are we going to receive this money? We're going to get it through Medicare, maybe a private payer, maybe it's rural health care or Medicaid, Indian Health Services or VA, or maybe our patients are cash pay. So we have a lot of different ways that we receive payments for diabetes education. So let's go over a few of the different models that are out there. So as far as billing practices, insurance companies provide a variety of payment schedules and degree of coverage. So some insurance companies may pay more for the same diabetes education than a different insurance company. So we're going to negotiate with the insurance companies, and of course we're going to always try and get the best reimbursement rates. And then there's a deductible that the patient is responsible for. So this is always the most difficult at the first of the year for a lot of our patients, when that bulk of the deductible is due. So if they sign up for your diabetes education program and they have a deductible of $1,000, they're going to get that bill early on. So we need to, be sensitive to that and check in with our patients. They might have a copay. But if they have Medicare and a secondary insurance, usually the diabetes education program is covered almost 100%. We want to sit down with our clients and develop a financial agreement with them to let them know that we're going to bill their insurance. If there's a copay or deductible, you're responsible for that. So we just want to be very open and upfront about that. And you might want to talk to your accounting department about setting up a release or an informational insurance release form so patients can sign that and agree that they're willing to pay. The other thing what Medicare says is that if you're billing Medicare for a service, you can't charge people less than the Medicare rates. So for example, you have a clinic where you're seeing a lot of indigent patients or cash pay patients, and you're also seeing Medicare patients. Well, you couldn't charge the cash pay any less than what you're getting paid by what Medicare is paying you for those educational services. If you bill Medicare for services, other patients and participants are not allowed to attend for free. And what we've done in that situation, because we have a lot of patients who can't afford our diabetes education program, we've set up a scholarship fund for patients who are cash pay or have a very large deductible, so that we can pay the fee, the Medicare rates, through our scholarship fund so that patient can attend our program. So there's ways around it, but I just want to let you know to be aware of the rules set forth by Medicare. Now, Medicaid is different. Medicaid insurance is partially federally funded, but it's administered by state. So each state has their own regulations around Medicaid, and it changes a lot as the economy changes. And with the new Affordable Health Care Act, it's going to change even more. So I would say this has a lot more dynamicism than Medicare does currently. So you can see that it sets rate of payment for services, administers its own program. Many are moving patients to HMOs. And generally speaking, diabetes education programs aren't covered by Medicaid. And Medicare will pay for diabetes education programs, but Medicaid, in our state, California, at least, tends to use a model where they see the provider and the diabetes educator one-on-one, and they'll reimburse for that. But for class settings, that is not usually the case. For the exam and for our clinical practice, it's important to have a basic understanding about the different parts of Medicare. Medicare Part A means a patient has the most basic type of Medicare, hospital insurance program. Medicare Part B is a supplemental medical insurance, and that's where we get coverage for the diabetes education programs and medical nutrition therapy. So you can see Part B, the supplemental insurance, is very important for patients who are involved in diabetes education, and it helps them with outpatient services and durable medical equipment. It is an elective program, but 95% of patients choose to participate. There is also Part C, Medicare Advantage, and this is like an HMO or PPO. It's a health coverage choice run by private companies approved by Medicare. And then there's D, the drug plan. This helps cover the cost of prescription drugs. For more information on Medicare and the coverage, I'm going to attach a printout informational pamphlet produced by Medicare, which describes all the different parts of Medicare and also the coverage that Medicare includes for diabetes. And this document is written for patients, so it's a great document to print out and share with your patients. And it also helps inform diabetes educators also of the parts of Medicare and the coverage. Many of our patients with Medicare also have an additional insurance, and this is called Medigap Supplemental Insurance. And when you have Medicare plus a secondary insurance, it can help pay for the deductible, coinsurance payments, and medications. It's administered by private payers, and the thing to know is that Medicare is always considered the primary payer source. So Medicare usually covers 80%, and the secondary insurance picks up the other 20%. So I know if a patient comes to see me and they have Medicare plus Blue Cross, most likely 100% of their diabetes education program will be covered, 80% by Medicare, 20% by their supplemental insurance. This is another important piece of information to keep in mind for the exam and for your clinical practice. Who is eligible to come to diabetes self-management education? Well, the Medicare criteria for referral says that the patient must have fasting blood sugar of 126 or greater times 2, or a random blood glucose of 200 or greater with symptoms, or 2-hour post-glucose challenge of 200 or greater times 2. So this is what the Medicare guidelines say. And on our referral form, we try to instruct our providers about these guidelines, because Medicare has not changed the guidelines since 2002. So they do not include A1C in their diagnostic criteria. They're simply relying on the fasting, random, or 2-hour post-meal blood sugars. So this is important information for you to include on maybe your referral form or in your education with providers, that these are the appropriate patients to refer. Now, what if your providers want to refer patients with pre-diabetes to you? They can certainly do that, but Medicare will not reimburse for pre-diabetes. So that is tricky. You might have to set up a separate, maybe a community class on prediabetes or see those patients in a different format, but they could not be covered by Medicare insurance. However, some private payers will pay for it. Like a lot of the HMOs realize that prediabetes is an important condition that we should, you know, really tackle head on to help slow the progression to diabetes or perhaps prevent diabetes for a time. So it just depends on your payer mix, but Medicare currently does not cover for prediabetes. This is their criteria for referral. Another very important thing to keep in mind is the Medicare final regulation for diabetes self-management training. And that is for when a patient enters your program for the first calendar year, they can receive 9 hours of group and 1 hour of individual. And when you bill for these, just know they're in half hour increments. So that's why I say they get 9 hours of group or 18 half hours, 1 hour individual or 2 1-half hours. The other thing that's really good to know about is Medicare will cover for 2 hours of follow-up diabetes self-management education annually. So you can, you know, what we do is we have a tickle file, and after a year we re-invite our patients to come back for an individual appointment. However, I want to let you know that the reimbursement rates are a little bit lower than the initial rates because you can't use the individual rate, which pays more, and we'll go over codes in a minute. You have to bill for using the group codes, so the payment schedule is a little bit less. To bill for Medicare, as we've mentioned before, you must be ADA or AADE recognized, and the patient must meet the criteria. These are the codes for diabetes self-management education, and I've put some websites here where you can look up the schedule and the payment schedule. But we have two different codes, and they're individual and group codes. So the individual code for billing Medicare is G0108. And I just put an example of how much the reimbursement rate is. For individuals, it's about $30 for 30 minutes or $60 for an hour. The group code is G0109, and that you can see the rate is a lot lower, about, you know, to say $17 to $20 for 30 minutes. So the reimbursement rate for group is less. So you could estimate, and this is all based on geography, so, you know, different locations have different reimbursement rates, so you might want to talk to your intermediary or your Medicare providers and ask what is the reimbursement rate in your community. This is helpful to know because you want to see if a patient attends all 10 hours, that is 9 hours of group and 1 hour of individual, how much revenue can you project that you will bring into your program? And in this situation, using these payment schedules, you can see for a patient engaged in our program for 10 hours, we're going to bring in about $363. So you could just roughly say that for 10 hours of education, we bring in about $400. And that will help you to make a realistic financial plan for your program and look at your goals. Medical nutrition therapy is also covered by Medicare, and this is pretty exciting because patients can get 3 hours initial benefit in their first calendar year. So that is really great news for our patients because medical nutrition therapy is really the cornerstone of diabetes self-management, plus they get 2 hours annual follow-up. And so this is a great service we can offer and encourage our patients to take advantage of. Again, the provider must be ADA or AADE recognized, and also there's coverage for MNT for diabetes and also kidney disease. I just wanted to list the CPT codes for medical nutrition therapy coding. So you can see here's the different codes when the dietitian works with the patients either individually for the initial face-to-face or reassessment, and then here's a group setting. And you can see the time frame is listed for each of these different codes. Medicare does cover for blood glucose testing supplies. This is important to know for our clinical practice, but also if you're going to take the exam, this question does come up. Medicare will help cover blood glucose monitor, strips, lancets, and glucose control solution. Here's the deal on the test strips. If a patient is not on insulin, they don't use insulin, they get 100 test strips every 3 months, which equals about 33 test strips a month. If they're on insulin, they get 100 test strips every month, which equals about 3 test strips per day. They also get one Lancet device every 6 months, and that's the actual device that holds the Lancets. And this is for people on insulin or patients who don't use insulin. This is also very important to note that if a patient has a medical necessity, they can get more strips and Lancets if necessary, but the provider will have to document that carefully. And then Medicare will also, for patients requiring extensive blood glucose testing, they'll ask the patient to fill in a form documenting their blood sugar and their medication dosage so that they can confirm that the patient does need these supplies. So this is important to know that Medicare does cover 80% of these different blood glucose testing supplies, and if the patient doesn't have additional insurance coverage, they may have to pay the other 20%, or if they do have additional insurance coverage, then there may be no out-of-pocket costs for them. Additionally, Medicare does cover therapeutic shoes, and if the patient meets the criteria, they're entitled to one pair of therapeutic shoes per year. This is really a terrific benefit for our patients with neuropathy or loss of protective sensation. They can get the depth inlay shoes and 3 pairs of insert or custom molded shoes and 2 pairs of inserts. But to qualify, the patient must have diabetes and one of the following complications. The qualified MD must write a prescription, and then the patient is referred to an orthotist or a specialist to fit the shoes. In addition, Medicare covers preventive services and services to keep people with diabetes healthy. If a person has risk factors for diabetes, Medicare will cover a screening test twice a year to determine if they have diabetes. Medicare covers diabetes self-management education and medical nutrition therapy, A1C tests, eye exams, flu and pneumonia vaccines yearly, foot care. Patients can see a foot doctor every 6 months if they have neuropathy. So this is very important for our patients to know, and it may cover more if serious foot problems do exist. Also, glaucoma testing is available for people with diabetes every 12 months. We definitely want to let our patients with diabetes know about these services so they take advantage of these different benefits that will help them stay healthy. As I've mentioned, Medicare will pay for diabetes self-management education training if your program is recognized by either the American Diabetes Association or the American Association of Diabetes Educators. For more information on the different elements and criteria for both of these programs, you can click on the link on the actual word itself, and I made it a hot link, so we'll go right to the website so you can look into more information about the differences and similarities of these programs. Once you achieve recognition, you must have a party with your team to celebrate that achievement. And I'm saying this kind of jokingly, but also seriously, because this party, you're going to invite your stakeholders, your community members, your administration. You're going to kick off your program with a bang and let everybody know that we are committed to providing the best diabetes education possible, and we are recognized and we're ready to go. You definitely, though, want to meet with your billing department and show them your proof, your certificate, so they can talk to your Medicare intermediary and the other insurance companies to show we are a recognized program. You want to make sure you set up your group and individual codes, letting your billing department know what codes to use. You want to determine rates. And in a lot of hospital settings, they automatically increase the rates every year based on inflation. And so you want to talk to your billing department and see if you want those rates to go up along with the other rates that are charged for different hospital activities or outpatient activities. So keep an eye on those. That's really important because the patients see the rate they are charged, and sometimes that can lead to confusion. As you know, a hospital bills a certain rate and they are reimbursed a much lower rate. And sometimes patients aren't aware of that, and that can be kind of a number that catches them off guard. You want to send a copy of your certificate and welcoming letter to your Medicare intermediary. You want to look at your billing rates versus actual revenue. So generally speaking, Whatever you bill, you probably will receive maybe 2/3 to 50% of what you bill as actual true dollars. You want to keep an eye on that and look at your mix of payers. Are you mostly Medicare? Are you mostly private pay? How is your revenue rolling in? And you might want to think about diversifying your revenue too. The other thing I want to mention, if patients do receive education through Medicare, they can only receive group classes once in a lifetime. You cannot have patients retake the classes once they've taken them. They can come back as an individual for medical nutrition therapy and diabetes self-management education, but not for the group classes. Marketing is a big part of any program's success, and our general message we want to share with our providers, our stakeholders, our community member is our diabetes program rocks. We're improving outcomes. Patients love our program. They feel very satisfied. We have great behavior change outcomes. We have great clinical outcomes. So we want to be a resource for you, community, to help your patients with diabetes have the best life possible. So we're going to get out there and we're going to spread the word about all the benefits of referring patients to our diabetes program. And at the same time, we're going to ask for input from our community, from our stakeholders. What do you want? What do you need in a diabetes program? What are you looking for? And then I always ask my patients, please let your providers know how you feel about our program. Share your success with your providers. And that's another good source of getting the word out about our diabetes program. I like thinking about this elevator introduction because as a diabetes educator, when I'm going out and talking to providers or clients or the community, I want to have a way in a very succinct, friendly, understandable way to describe what our program does. What is the benefit of our program? Why would you want to refer? What services do we provide? What sets us apart? And from the competition, what makes us unique and special? So we want to, you know, let our providers and referring people and community members know about our program in a short, succinct way that's engaging. And so this is a nice thing to kind of practice saying out loud or practice with your friends and neighbors and just say, ask me about my program, and then tell them and see how that feels for you. It has to be wording that's comfortable for you and that is honestly represents the benefits of your program. Increasing provider referrals is an ongoing project that all educators need to be engaged in. So here's some different ways we can actually appeal to our patients directly. So we could say to our patients, let your doctor know that you want to come to diabetes education, and then they can ask their provider. Or sometimes we have patients call our department directly, and then we send a referral to the provider. So we could directly market to our patients or to the providers. We could also do advertising. We could provide lunches, CE activities, hallway conferences. I love those. You know, when the doctors are making rounds, it's a good time to catch them and just, you know, shake their hand, introduce yourself, and let them know of the services that are available. Or maybe you're working with one of their patients. Just check in with them about their patients. Oh, for all the new providers who come into our town, we send them a welcome packet with a referral, with a nice letter, and with our brochures about our program. Testimonials from patients, you know, whatever we can do to help keep the word out about our program and keep patients coming, because if we don't have patients, we can't succeed. So we really need those ongoing referral sources and checking in with those who refer to us to make sure they're happy with the service and is there anything we could do to make it better. We talked about increasing self-referrals. Here's some strategies to make this happen. I think word of mouth is such an important part of self-referrals. Special events can also help with you reaching out to the community. And we do write a lot of press releases and articles that appear in the paper and our employee newsletter, any way to get the word out about diabetes. And the support group is another way, inviting people to a support group and then inviting them over to your classes. So these are just some ideas. I'm sure you have some great ones too. And it's nice that we can share these with each other to help improve patient participation. Some high-profile events offer us the opportunity to market our programs too. As I mentioned before, when you get ADA recognition, or maybe if you're renewing your recognition of your program, You could have a party. And then there's a bunch of diabetes special events. In March, we have Sound the Alert Day. We're trying to find people with diabetes. November is National Diabetes Month, so we have a whole month to raise awareness. And then the United Nations has declared November 14th World Diabetes Day. So that's another great day to have a special event, a candlelight ceremony, have your staff dress in blue. And what I'll do is I'll make links on these so you can click on these and see different resources for these different special events that you could print out and have available for your communities. The other thing you might want to do is hold a walk for diabetes. Maybe you do it in conjunction with the JDRF or the ADA, or maybe you do it in conjunction with the Let's Move community. So holding a walk is a great way to raise awareness about diabetes and kind of share what you're doing with your community. When all is said and done, our overall goal is to provide awesome diabetes self-care training. We want our patients to feel empowered. We want them to have resources. We want them to feel confident that they can make the changes in behavior to improve their health span and their daily quality of life. I'd like to bring your attention to some resources published by the American Association of Diabetes Educators for your clinical practice and your test preparation, The Art and Science of Diabetes Self-Management and Diabetes Review Guide. Both of these books are excellent study tools and also excellent references for your diabetes education program. And if you click on this link, our website offers discounted prices on both of these books. Thank you so much for joining our web clinic. You have up to 1 year to complete this program and take the post-test and receive your CE credit from time of purchase. To receive your CE credit, just complete the post-test and complete the program survey. Now your certificate is ready to print out. If you would like to see a record of all of your courses and your test results, go to the transcripts page for more information. We invite you to join us on Facebook for special events and coupon codes. And keep in touch. We would love to hear from you, and we want to support your journey in your role in diabetes education. This is Beverly Tomasian signing off.